Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Astronomy from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. My name's Ian Todd, I'm the magazine's staff writer, and I'm here with Elizabeth Pearson, who is the magazine's news editor. And it's a rather special episode this month, isn't it, Ez?
Yes, we're actually at Jodrell Bank in Manchester at the Blue Dot Festival 2018. So to tell you a little bit more about Jodrell Bank and the Blue Dot Festival, here's our first interviewee.
So I'm here with Teresa Anderson, Director of the Discovery Centre here at Jodrell Bank. Thank you very much for speaking to me, Teresa.
Yeah, good, no problem.
The story of Jodrell Bank is just, it's quite an exciting story, isn't it? I mean, the kind of history of Bernard Lovell and how he came to find it. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's, with hindsight, it all seems terribly, you know, regulated and, you know, he was a terribly important person and it was all very serious. And in fact, it was a little bit seat of the pants, frankly, because he came back from the war in 1945 and didn't really return to his work in the lab in Manchester, the University of Manchester, on cosmic rays, but started to work on with radar that he'd been working with during the war, and basically acquired, goodness knows how, a load of army surplus radar kit that they took to the physics department of Manchester, which didn't work because of the interference in the trams that were going up and down the road outside, causing sparks. And so he said, oh, is there somewhere else I can go? And the university said, oh, well, we've got these botany testing grounds at Jodrell Bank. You can go for 2 weeks. Well, here we are at Blue Dot, you know, quite a while later. Of course, obviously, he never left, and he carried on his experiments with army surplus kit, gradually moved up through all of the fields on site, putting down concrete, acquiring more army surplus kit, people who came to work for him. And really what happened was slowly the new science of radio astronomy emerged. And it's funny now, you know, these days we're used to kind of multi-wavelength astronomy and, you know, telescopes that are infrared or gamma ray or whatever it is. But back in those days, it was optics or nothing. You know, it was like you look through it or, you know, that was it. And really, when the first radio instruments started to detect signals from outside, our extragalactic radio signals, and then you suddenly realise, actually, they're quite handy for picking up some sorts of information that you can't pick up with an optic telescope. Suddenly, you've got a new science. And once you're into that part of the EM spectrum, off you go, you know, and now we've got multi-wavelength astronomy right across the spectrum.
So what does radio astronomy allow us to see that we can't see in optical light?
Well, if you look at the images, and you know it's hard to sort of talk people through it, what radio astronomy sees is, if you like, the radio emissions from the gaps between the stars. Stars generally don't emit much radio radiation, but you know, black holes at the heart of galaxies do, quasars do, and the dust between the stars glows because the cosmic microwave background. It's microwave, but, you know, really it's radio, sort of. You know, these sorts of things tell us things that you can't... It's like, you know, there's a sort of whole jigsaw of all the different wavelengths gives us different bits of information. And, you know, for example, out in our exhibition here, because we've got a public discovery centre here, we've got a little exhibit where you can look at something in different wavelengths. So you can look at the CERN or the moon or the galaxy or whatever. And really, you know, it really brings it home to you when you look, say, you know, the cosmic microwave background overlaid with, you know, an infrared image of the galaxy, or in fact an optical image of the Milky Way, you know, just how different the sets of information are you get with different wavelengths.
At the very start of when Jodrell Bank was founded, I mean, it played actually quite an important role in the kind of the space race and the Cold War, didn't it? Which is quite funny to think of that.
No, I know. And just one of these things, you know, really the telescope doesn't do what it's supposed to do now, what it was set up to do. It does entirely different things. Now, I remember Sir Bernard saying, you know, before he passed away, and I think it was 2012 he passed away, you know, it does things that we never... It looks at things we never even dreamed existed when we built it. You know, so it's got this sort of feeling that actually it's done a ton of things that were never intended. And one of the things that happened, because its construction coincided with the dawn of the space race, space age, if you like, the very first thing it did was it tracked the carrier rocket for Sputnik 1, which was the first human-made satellite launched into above our atmosphere. And, you know, and really worked with both the USA and the USSR through that fantastic space race between the two of them, which is a real spur, you know, to the space, humankind's leap into space. And, you know, it's easy, you know, with hindsight to think about the Apollo missions and the moon landings, especially since it's the 49th anniversary this year. But actually, until... you know, the Eagle lander got down, it's touch and go who was going to win it. And really, the Soviets were doing quite well. And, you know, you read stories at the time about, you know, the USA sending up a satellite. They went into solar orbit. And you think, what you mean it missed? You know, sort of, it didn't quite go where, to the moon or whatever, you know. So I think, you know, and the massive radio telescopes and the radars here were used throughout by both sides. I mean, I was saying earlier today, you know, in a way, Jodrell Bank was a bit sort of like a scientific Switzerland, and that it worked really for the good of science with everybody throughout the Cold War. It's quite a sort of exciting principle, really.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the things that really strikes me about the history of Jodrell Bank. I mean, given that the United Kingdom was effectively an ally of the USA in the Cold War, was there no pressure on him and on the observatory, given the fact that he was helping the Soviets?
Well, I think there was, yeah. And I think he, you know, certainly had quite chats with quite a few people from the intelligence service. And, you know, he visited the USSR at times when, you know, nobody else got a visa or travelled. You know, was sort of baited, you know, as this amazing sort of visiting dignitary. And also the same happened to him in the USA. And, you know, he tells the story of when he went to the USSR, they tried to persuade him to stay and offered him, you know, fantastic funding, wonderful labs, the instruments as large as he wanted and all the rest of it. And the quote was, "I'm an Englishman and I belong in England." And, you know, he wanted to get back home to cricket and playing the church organ and cream teas or whatever. But, you know, there's this real sort of sense that that scientific collaboration somehow... And you don't know why, somehow, was seen as a higher thing and it was more noble, and people recognised actually it's a really important, fundamental human thing that we've all got to collaborate, you know, on everything that we do together. I mean, that's one of the things about this Blue Dot Festival, you know, it's very much this sense of we're all on this planet, and actually in the universe it's quite a little thing. And you know, in the universe, life as complex as ours seems to be quite a rare thing. I mean, you know, I hope in my lifetime we'll discover otherwise. But, you know, for now, we've got to look after it. We've got to look after the planet. And we've got to collaborate and work together on it all.
And obviously, Jodrell Bank today is kind of is part of that looking out into the cosmos. Can you tell us a little bit about the work it does today, and also kind of more in the recent history, because it's been involved in kind of the discovery of pulsars and things like that, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Yeah. I mean, so the discovery of pulsars really has to be handed to Cambridge, and you know, much as we'd like to claim it, actually they did discover them, and Jocelyn Bell Burnell, of course. You know, was the woman who was instrumental in that. And after that, though, Jodrell's become world-leading, really, in work on pulsars. And we've got a really, really crack pulsar team here who, you know, I'd be surprised if the Lovell wasn't working on pulsars even through the middle of Blue Dot Festival, apart from the fact that it's part because we're working on it. But, you know, it's the bread and butter of Jodrell Bank, really, you know, that's what we work on. And then, of course, there is... Jodrell Bank has always been involved, to some extent, in SETI, a little bit. But we do have a number of people who are very interested in it. So the new director of the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, Mike Garrett, is a SETI person. So, you know, he's going to be taking that programme forward quite a lot. And, of course, Tim O'Brien's worked on it quite a lot as well. So there's a bunch of people who are very interested. And, of course, wouldn't it be the big thing? It really would be, yeah.
It really is a fantastic structure as well. We heard Tim O'Brien say yesterday that he's kind of assuming or presuming it's the only Grade 1 listed building in the world that's on wheels.
No, I said that in the talk as well. It's a thing that we all do say, actually. We think that's right. And it also is a Grade 1 listed structure that doesn't have planning permission. Because apparently Bernard Lovell went into the planning office and said, "I'm going to build this new telescope." And they said, "Does it move?" And he said, "Oh, yes." Even though it just moves on the spot. And they said, "Oh, well, you don't need planning permission for it." So that's quite interesting too.
And so how did the Blue Dot Festival actually come to be? Whose idea was it?
So Tim and I were very, very committed to this idea of science being a part of culture and society. And actually, you know, anyone who works in science knows that if you've got any public funding, there's a democracy that we operate in, and actually the people have to want science to go forward, especially blue skies research that doesn't immediately deliver economic impact. So, you know, there's a whole kind of public duty thing. As well as that, science is fun and really exciting. And a lot of people in the cultural sectors think that. And a lot of people think that, and that, but have no way to connect with science. And then a lot of people in science have, you know, very little overlap with the cultural sectors. So we've got this new Discovery Centre here that we opened in 2011. And we decided when we opened it, what we would do is start doing some music events as well. And so the first music event we did was a one-nighter in 2011. And from then, we've gone on and we've done several years where we've done one-nighters and things. But this is the third year that we've actually done the camping festival, Blue Dot. And the reason that we moved from the one-nighters to the camping... Well, one of the reasons. One of the reasons is it's fantastic. You get a real atmosphere and there's people on site all weekend and it really builds this sort of... And it is a fantastic site for it, you know. And people are living in the presence of science, you know. It's just kind of really great thing. But one of the other reasons is very, very practical, is if you run a one-nighter, it's kind of like a step function. You know, everybody arrives at once. So everybody wants to park at once. The roads get clogged. Everyone comes out of their car and goes, oh, where's the loo? And then everyone goes, oh, I'm starving. So the queues for everything are massive. But if you have a camping festival, people drift in and then they, you know, use the facilities when they want, they get the food when they want, and suddenly it takes all the pressure off everything and it's much more mellow and relaxed. And actually, although you have to build a small town with, you know, a campsite and lighting and generators and, you know, a rubbish collection, a bin service and water and all the rest of it, actually it makes for a nicer festival altogether and less stress for everybody.
I completely agree. It's the third year of the camping and it's BBC Sky Night Magazine's second year here. And we enjoyed last year and we're enjoying this year. So
it's good.
Thank you very much for having us and thank you very much for speaking to us
today. Oh, you're very welcome. Do come again next year.
We will indeed.
Thank you.
I'm here with Rachel Platonov, who's a senior lecturer in Russian studies at the University of Manchester, and she's just given a talk about how the Cold War affected the space race. So we've all heard, in the West anyway, we've heard a lot about how the US viewed the space race and how it involved in the Cold War. What were the sort of main differences between how the Soviet Union viewed it and how the Americans viewed it?
I think, in fact, there were quite a lot of similarities that from the Soviet perspective, as from the American perspective, it was very much about ideological competition as well as about developing technologies that had military capacity. And so, for example, the kinds of firsts that the Soviet Union was able to achieve in the space race, launching the Sputnik 1 satellite, putting the first man in space, putting the first woman in space, were viewed not just as achievements of science and technology, but also as achievements of the Soviet system more generally. The Soviet system was superior to the American one, therefore it could make these firsts, it could achieve these things before the Americans could.
Sputnik, obviously it was seen as a kind of a defeat in the US. How was it seen in Russia?
In the Soviet Union, it was very much viewed as a victory of communism in the battle with capitalism. So proof, again, that the Soviet system was superior to the American one. And it was really very much like, for Americans, putting the first man on the moon was an event that people remembered, that they marked their lives by. Everyone remembers where they were when this happened. In the Soviet Union, people remembered where they were when Sputnik was launched, where they were when Gagarin went into space and these sorts of things.
It very much seemed that the Soviet Union sort of started out winning the space race. Was that how they sort of portrayed it over there?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
But then things started to go a bit wrong when they started going to... They had a bit of trouble getting to the moon, didn't they?
Yes.
What was going wrong there?
Lack of technology, I guess. There were certain technological achievements or areas of space technology in which the Soviet Union was very much ahead of the U.S. in the early stages, you know, late 1950s and early 1960s. But lunar travel was one area where they simply didn't have adequate technology to do this. The Luna 15 mission that the Soviets sent to the moon that actually reached lunar orbit before Apollo 11 did, crash-landed on the moon, and it was an unmanned mission. So at the point where the U.S. was sending a manned mission to the moon, it's worth pointing out, actually, that that moon landing took place on the 20th of July, 1969, so it's a very fitting date to be talking about that today, on the 20th of July, 2018. So the Soviet Union simply wasn't able to keep up in this race for lunar travel.
We're stood here under the shadow, pretty much, of the Lovell telescope. So I know that Jodrell Bank was very involved in the space race.
Very much so.
How did the Russians use Jodrell Bank?
As a monitoring station to provide independent confirmation of their various launches. For example, Jodrell Bank was asked to monitor the second Luna mission, moon mission, because the first one was believed widely outside the Soviet Union to have been mere propaganda. No one believed that the Soviet Union had actually sent a satellite and tried to reach lunar orbit. So the Soviet Union countered that by launching another one and using Jodrell Bank to get independent verification of its success. So those were the kinds of ways in which Jodrell Bank was used. A similar thing happened in 1967 when the Soviet Union launched a Venus probe and again asked Jodrell Bank to monitor it so that they had someone other than their own scientists, other than their own journalists, making this claim about what they'd achieved.
Well, thank you very much. That was a very interesting talk you just gave, and thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Philippa Browning, who is a solar expert from the University of Manchester, and he's just been giving a talk on solar flares. Philippa, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Hi.
How did you first become interested in the sun? What was the inspiration behind you deciding to study the sun as your career?
I always had an interest in astronomy from a small child, but actually I kind of went off and slightly did other things. I did a degree in maths, and so it was partly chance that I came back to the sun and to astrophysics when I did my PhD. And I think what I realised when I was choosing my PhD place was that there was a lot of really exciting new stuff about the sun, and partly that was the era when we were starting to look at the sun from space. It was actually Skylab in those days, and it was sending for the first time pictures of the corona from space. And I realised this was really, a very hot subject, and there was a lot of new things going on, and it would be a good field to be involved in.
It might seem like quite a simple and perhaps silly question to someone like you, but I was wondering if you could just explain what actually is the sun? Like, can you actually explain what it consists of?
Well, the sun is a star, yeah. Of course, which means it is, in some sense, a huge ball of very hot gas, which is held together by gravity. So on the one hand, all matter attracts itself, so it's gravity that keeps it together. But on the other hand, it's generating energy by nuclear fusion, and that is constantly heating it up. And so you have a kind of competition between the fact it's being heated up by the generation of energy, which wants to make it fly apart, and gravity wants to make it sort of all pull together. And that keeps it, in general, in this very sort of stable, state, which is, what we call a star. And the sun is just, sort of one of many stars, but in some sense a very typical one. It's about halfway through its life. It's a bit on the small side, but, a similar size to many other stars. And, in some sense, unremarkable as stars go.
But it's also very dynamic, isn't it? I mean, you've been talking about solar flares today.
So the atmosphere of the sun is very dynamic. So the sort of interior, the sort of body of the sun is largely, pretty stable. It does have, in the outer layers, it's convecting, it's sort of churning away, basically, like, a pot of soup on the stove, sort of bubbling away. But as you get into the atmosphere, and in particular into the corona, it is incredibly active. It's very changeable. It's very dynamic. So it's doing things, things like flares, which, these kind of explosions, but it's also changing over the solar cycle. So a lot of things going on, yeah.
What actually causes solar flares? How do they actually manifest themselves? What actually are they?
Well, what we see, the most immediate thing, I think you could say, that what we see as a solar flare is a large and a very sort of sudden burst of X-rays and extreme ultraviolet emission. So the corona is sort of giving out X-rays sort of all the time, but in a flare you get a sort of big burst. There's actually sort of bursts of radiation in lots of different wavelengths. So you see radio waves, for example, big bursts of radio waves, microwaves, some visible light and so on. So that's kind of what you see. But what's causing that is, we believe, it's all coming from the magnetic field. So you're basically building up energy in the magnetic field. It's getting sort of stressed, and then suddenly it just kind of gives, and a lot of that energy is released very suddenly, and that's a flare.
And does this have any effect on Earth?
Yeah, it certainly can do. It can have a lot of effects. I mean, one effect is the X-rays. So when those X-rays and ultraviolet light, when they obviously, you know, impact on the atmosphere of the Earth, particularly the sort of outer atmosphere, the ionosphere, then that changes the properties a bit of that outer atmosphere. And that can be quite important, for example, for radio propagation. So some radio waves, you know, use the ionosphere to propagate around the Earth. And if that changes, you can get radio blackouts. But also the flare is giving like great sort of streams of very high energy particles. Those can hit the Earth and have effects, you know, particularly on satellites. And the Earth's magnetic field can be disrupted. And that can have lots of effects as well on sort of our different technologies.
Is this the sort of thing that someone might notice, say you're using your sat-nav in your car? Is it the kind of thing that could knock off something like
that? Yeah, I think potentially, because a satellite, all those things are controlled by satellites, basically. So we use GPS and that to do with satellites. And then if there is a solar storm and then the instrumentation in that satellite is hit by, you know, a cloud of particles from the sun, then it could stop operating, perhaps temporarily, or it could be, you know, kind of destroyed altogether. But even temporarily, yes, suddenly everything like your sat nav could fail, your mobile phone could fail, lots of systems could go. So it is actually a very big concern, because we're so dependent on these things nowadays.
Yeah, but also from your talk, it seemed to come across that there's still quite a lot we don't know about how the sun works and how the space weather works, and there's still quite a lot we need to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of things we don't understand, and to some extent, I think it's the more we discover, the more we realise, you know, you find out new things, but that just throws up new questions, basically. But one of the things that's been a problem for quite a while is why the temperature in the corona is about a million degrees, whereas the temperature at the surface is only a few thousand degrees. And that is obviously incredibly surprising. You just expect it would get cooler as you go further away from the centre of the sun. And I say, as you go up into the corona, it actually gets hotter. And we kind of understand a bit. We know it's something to do with the magnetic field, that you're sort of building up energy in the magnetic field and somehow dissipating that. But the details are still not understood at all, and there's kind of competing theories, and, you know, nobody knows for sure exactly how it works. Mm. So it's quite a major thing, and we really don't understand it.
Presumably that's what a lot of your work at the University of Manchester is about. I mean, what do you and your colleagues kind of do on a daily basis, and what's your research involved in?
So what we do at Manchester is we're on the theoretical side, so we don't actually do observations. I mean, there are obviously people who like, or mostly, we do a little bit actually, but that's not our main thing. Our main thing is doing theories, particularly computer simulations, trying to understand things like, you know, how is the corona heated? How do we get this energy out of the magnetic field? Again, in a flare, how do we get the energy out? How does this accelerate the particles? And we're trying to understand a process called magnetic reconnection, which is generally believed to be behind flares, the magnetic field lines basically breaking and reconnecting, and that gives out all the energy. But a lot of how it works is not understood. So I say we're developing models of that and then trying to compare those with the observations and sort of make predictions of what people should see. And, you know, together with the theory and observations, that should take us closer to answering some of these questions.
And presumably we will learn a lot more in the next 5 years or so, because there are a few missions planned.
That's right, yeah. There's some very exciting things coming. In fact, very soon, I think August the 4th or within a couple of weeks of that, we hope to have Parker Solar Probe launched, which is a NASA mission. And that is something described as a mission which is going to the sun. So it's going to get incredibly close to the sun. So it's going to be just 8 solar radii above the surface of the sun. So that really is in the inner corona. And so it is literally going to be sitting inside the inner corona and sort of measuring the plasma around it, far, far closer than any, you know, man-made thing has ever been before. And so that is very exciting. And a year or two after that, there's going to be a European mission called Solar Orbiter, which is also going to go very close to the sun, but not quite as close, about a quarter of the distance from the sun to the Earth. But that's going to look both at, again, the plasma that it's sitting in at the solar wind, but also it's going to look at the sun and kind of put the two things together. So, for example, you might see a flare go off and it'll be watching the flare go off, and then the sort of stuff will come off from the flare, and then it will actually, the spacecraft will actually be sitting in it, and so it will be able to sort of see what comes past it. And that also is going to fly basically in, at high latitudes, sort of over the poles of the sun. So we'll get a view of the sun that we don't normally have. We normally always see it kind of side on. We're looking at the equator, basically, and we'll be able to see those higher latitudes.
So for those interested in the sun and the secrets of the sun, it's exciting times ahead,
yeah,
I guess.
Very exciting, yeah. So watch out for Solar Orbiter and Parker Solar Probe, definitely.
Philippa, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Monica Grady, a professor of planetary and space science from the Open University. She's just been talking about the prospects of finding extraterrestrial intelligence. So I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about what's being done to try and find these extraterrestrial intelligences?
And so I was talking about something called the Drake equation, which is, I describe it not as an equation, but more like the back of an envelope calculation, a rough idea of, you know, well, what's the chances of finding any, because this was an expression put together by Frank Drake 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, when he was trying to assess, well, there's lots of stars, there might be lots of planets. Remember, at the time he was doing it, we hadn't found any planets around other stars. And so he was trying to assess, you know, how many stars, how many planets with water on that aren't too hot, not too cold, how many of those have got life on them, you know, on and on and on, until you get to a number, which is how many of the stars that have got planets, that have got this, have got intelligent communicating civilizations that have lasted a reasonable amount of time on their planetary body. So it's a lot of probabilities, let's say, or improbabilities.
And so there's a lot of probabilities in that the Drake equation. How are people sort of trying to narrow those down and work out what those probabilities might be?
So there are 8 terms in the Drake equation, and 4 of them are sort of well known. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the number of stars in the Milky Way, we more or less know that. The number of planets around stars, we sort of know that. Or we've been measuring them using telescopes like the Kepler space mission that was looking for extra solar planets. So we've got 4 of those bits of the expression. I've got real numbers, proper numbers. Mm-hmm. Now, when Frank Drake was doing this, like, none of them have real numbers, so it's fantastic. The other 4 are the ones where you start to wave your arms a bit more, but they will potentially become better known. So it's things like the number of bodies on which life has arisen. Well, we only know of one at the moment, but you never know. If we explore Mars, we might be able to find more. The number of places where life has got going and has started to communicate, we don't know. But the more we keep exploring, the more extrasolar planets we find, and the more that are rocky and, you know, got water and all that sort of stuff, the more we keep exploring, the better the limits are, the narrower the limits are on these numbers. So eventually, you never know, we might get down to a proper number.
Mm. And so how are people actually sort of going about trying to sort of search out for these extraterrestrial intelligences?
Well, the main way that we're searching for them is by listening for them, all right? Because the nearest star is 4 light years away, so it takes light 4 years to get to us. So if you've got any, you know, communicating civilization there, it's going to take them a heck of a long time to get there, to get to us. And so we're listening for signals which travel at the speed of light. We're listening for radio signals. We're listening for particular patterns of radio signals. And we're more in the listening mode rather than the speaking mode, although we have made attempts in the past to send out specific signals. And we are broadcasting all the time ourselves from light, from the Earth, radiation from the Earth. So there aren't any specific space missions that are going to look for alien civilizations. There has been space mission, and there are other ones planned which are looking for extrasolar planets, and once we've really got to grips with those, we'll be looking for extrasolar planets with atmospheres and all those other things, rather than just saying, well, right, we found another 400 planets or whatever. And so as the technology gets better, we will be able to investigate those exoplanets more closely, more thoroughly. But given that they're around stars which are, you know, 10 20, 50 light years away, what the chances of us ever actually meeting face to face with an extraterrestrial civilization, I think, is unlikely.
Has there been much thought put into what people would actually do if they did manage to find a message?
I don't know, is the short answer to that one. There has been discussion about, you know, what if we find microorganisms on Mars, which is the most likely type of extraterrestrial species we could find. But extraterrestrial intelligence, if something did arrive and sort of said, you know, here I am, talk to me, I don't know, what would we do? You know, let me bounce the question back to you. What would you do?
I'd get very excited and then probably have a little panic.
Yeah.
And because I know there's quite a lot of, famously, the late Stephen Hawking sort of said that perhaps we shouldn't be broadcasting these messages out to people. Yeah. And that we might be, that might be slightly dangerous. And I was wondering, what's your thought on that?
I don't think it's dangerous, because one would hope that if there was an extraterrestrial civilization that was communicating and had been communicating for a significant part of its existence as a planet, then they would have got to a stage when they know that you get a lot further by collaboration and communication than you do by warfare. That you're much better trying to make friends with people rather than making war at them. You know, all the Hollywood blockbusters that have so many, you know, Independence Day and all that sort of stuff, you know. No, I just don't go for it.
You just have to look at the International Space Station to see that the only way that we can advance in the universe is by working together.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Some interesting food for thought, Monica. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Well, that's it from us at Blue Dot 2018. It's been a fantastic weekend. Have you enjoyed it, Iz?
I've really enjoyed it. It's been really interesting to hear lots of talks, see lots of music, and learn all about space.
And, of course, next year, the festival will probably coincide with the
50th anniversary of the Apollo landings on the moon. So that should be interesting. I'll definitely be back next year.
Exactly. From all of us at BBC Skynet Magazine, thanks very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.